make sure to give my dad a 5-star review.
Make sure to like and subscribe to his YouTube. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
So, for instance, there are two ways to respect the authorities. And one of them is by obeying the good laws. And the other one is by openly suffering the consequences of disobeying the bad laws. So I've gone to jail for civil disobedience, for nonviolently, prayerfully trying to stand against unjust laws. One of those, I believe, is executing people, right?
Wow.
So I'm willing to kneel down in front of the machinery of death to say, please don't do this.
Hi, welcome guys to Faithful Politics. This is Josh Bertram, the faithful host, and we have with us Will, the thrill, right?
Occasionally.
Who's never wrong, occasionally right. And he is he's our political host. And we have with us today Shane Claiborne, which I'm very excited about. I've been following Shane's work for over a decade now. Shane is a Christian activist, and he's also author of several books, including the one we're going to talk about today called Executing Grace. And he's a founding member of the nonprofit The Simple Way in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Shane, thanks so much for being on. Is there anything you would like me to add to your autobiography here? I guess biography here.
No, it's great to be with y'all. I always say set the bar low so I can only go up from there. You know, it's great to be here. It's great to talk about this particular topic we're getting ready to dive into, because I think it opens a whole can of worms, as they say. You know, it's just all kinds of other stuff that yes, you get into. So it's great to be with y'all.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. And thanks so much for being on again. It's such a pleasure and an honor, really. And so we'll just jump right into it. So I read your book in preparation for a podcast. I say I read it. I listened to like probably 60% of it. And then I read with like the, you know, the Audible thing where you can now, it follows like the words in the book. And so you can read it. And so I did that for the other 40%. I, you know, honestly, one of the things you talk about in the book is how you used to be pro capital punishment. And we'll give you a chance to talk about that. And then kind of shifted your thinking on it through the years, had an evolution on that subject through the years. And I would say that a lot of what you talked about in that book hit home with me, especially because, you know, I just basically never even thought about the death penalty. I just assumed it was right, and still have my views on it. And I'll just full disclosure, I do support it in very limited cases. But your book really challenged me in a way that I'd never been challenged on this subject before. And so I guess to start off with, talk about us for audience, your evolution on this subject and what inspired you to move from what you say is basically a pro-capital punishment position to one like a very ardent opposer of it, an activist against it.
Well, yeah, thanks, y'all. And I think it does give me a little bit of humility and generosity when I'm having conversations with people that disagree with where I'm at now, because 20 years ago, I disagreed with where I'm at now, you know, and I've kind of really, I guess as many years as I've been against the death penalty, I was for it, you know, and I grew up in East Tennessee. And I was telling you guys before, I guess not everybody can see the video, but I got my fly fishing rod behind me here. You know, I grew up hunting. I grew up very comfortable with guns, you know? So a lot of the things that I've rethought have been, in light of my faith and, you know, my commitment to Jesus. And also I think a big part of this too, is about proximity. I got to know people who were wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death for crimes they had nothing to do with. You know, I also got to know murder victims' family members that experienced things that I can't even imagine. Like my friend Suzanne Bosler, who I'll be with in a few days in a virtual event, her dad was killed. He was a pastor. She barely survived the crime. She was stabbed multiple times in the head. And she walked away that traumatized, but also deeply convinced that the death penalty wasn't the best solution. That her dad as a pastor wouldn't want that because he always believed in grace and redemption. And even herself, she believed that the death penalty just kind of mirrors the evil that we're trying to heal the world of. So, you know, there's a lot of things like that. I think that sometimes our hearts move before our heads move, you know, and that happened for me. I think it became personal. As the more I got to know people that were directly impacted by capital punishment, and it caused me to go back to my scripture and reread the Bible, and to see some of the holes in my own theology. Yeah, that's kind of what happened for me.
Man, that's amazing. What were you going to say, Will?
Well, I was going to say it's interesting. So we recently spoke to a constitutional professor, Karina Lane, who has been studying the death penalty, capital punishment for, as long as she's been alive. And she explained to us that she used to be for it, and then she became against it, like kind of the further that, you know, she studied it. And she's a Christian also, but I don't necessarily think that her faith colors her belief about the capital punishment. She just thinks it's just really, really wrong, you know? And so I really appreciate, you know, just your ability to take your experience and shift it or do a 180 on it. Cause I think most people have a hard time, changing their minds about something that they felt so adamant about for so long.
I've always liked that there's a scripture that talks about how we're working out our salvation with fear and trembling. Mm-hmm. And I really like that because I've come to see that this whole journey of faith is not about a moment, but it really is about a movement of the Spirit shaping and transforming us. So that, you know, for me, that's been, you know, decades long now of trying to figure some of these things out. But, you know, I've come to see that a lot of these issues that we think of as political issues, like the death penalty, they certainly are, but they're also spiritual issues. And there's something deeply, really for me, that goes to the very heart of our faith when we talk about the death penalty, because one of the questions among the many that it raises is, the question is anybody beyond redemption, you know, like even if we know somebody that's done something horrible, do we believe, as scripture says, that where sin abounds, grace abounds, you know, that Jesus who said, I've not come for the healthy, but for the sick. And that's really what, I believe at the end of the day is that, the Bible would be a lot shorter without grace. And in the end, this is a story of how good God is, in spite of how, evil the things that we can do to each other are. And, you know, as I look at the Bible and go back, I've rethought some things, you know, like I learned about David as a man after God's own heart, but you read two chapters of the Bible and he pretty much just shreds the Ten Commandments, you know. He ends up raping a woman named Bathsheba, having her husband Uriah killed. You know, I mean, it's just brutal. And Moses, you know, killed someone. Saul of Tarsus, you know, who we know as Paul, wrote half the New Testament. He was, by every definition, a religious extremist. I mean, I think you could even say a terrorist. He terrorized the early church and oversaw the first execution. You know, I mean, so these were brutal figures that grace, you know, gets the last word in their life. And so I really think that if we believe that murderers are beyond redemption, we could rip out half the Bible because it was written by them.
I agree. And, you know, I thought that was an amazing point that you made in the book, that the Bible would be a lot shorter if it weren't for grace, and that we wouldn't have, you know, the books that Moses wrote or Paul wrote or the books that David wrote and the Psalms. And I think that's I think that's such a good point. One of my questions has to do with, so you make this really, like, one of the things you talk about in your book is that that victims, we would actually assume that all victims of someone who's been brutally murdered, which of course is just horrible, that they would be for the death penalty. But you actually make a point that many of the victims that you interact with and have experienced are actually against the death penalty. You even gave an example of your friend just a few moments ago. And why do you feel like that's important for us to understand, that the victims of these families that have been so tragically changed forever, oftentimes are actually against the death penalty?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things I began to learn as I leaned into all of this is that there is sort of a one narrative around what justice for victims of murder looks like, right? And for many people, that means the harshest punishment possible, which often can mean the death penalty, right? And what I've learned from many murder victims' family members is that we can honor the victims of violence without doing more violence. And really, the death penalty extends the trauma. It creates a new set of victims, right? It exacerbates the wounds of violence. It offers this kind of false promise of closure and healing, but it really is a lie, you know. And I think that one of the things that we really have to insist on, though, is that to be against the death penalty is not to be against justice, or certainly not against victims, but just to say that we believe that violence is the problem, not the solution, right? Like this is the disease, not the cure. So we don't rape people who rape to show how wrong it is to rape. And yet we hold out this logic that we're going to kill to try to show that killing is wrong. And what we really end up doing is mirroring that very evil. So yeah, someone like Suzanne Bosler, I mean, this is where it really opened my eyes. She's now a dear friend. She's been a part of an organization called Journey of Hope, which incidentally brings together murder victims' family members with the family members of folks on death row and people whose loved ones were executed together to really stand against all violence, right? Whether it's done by a criminal or whether it's done by the state. And one of the things that Suzanne, I wrote about her in my book, Executing Grace. But when the violent crime happened that took her father's life, that she basically survived by faking her own death, right? And the man left. And she, as she recovered, she just had this really deep sense that, like, this man is sick. He is sick and he needs to be locked up, but we can protect innocent people without killing him. And there's also this sort of sense that we always want to hold out hope that someone is better or more than the worst thing that they've ever done, right? And that something can happen that might heal maybe even some of the wounds that have shaped who they are as a violent person, right? So anyway, she stood against the death penalty. But here's what's really gets absolutely bizarre is when this went to trial, she was told in court that she could not be publicly against the death penalty or she would be considered an obstacle of justice, right? Because it was the state pursuing the death penalty. And so literally in court, she mentioned her opinion that she didn't want the person to be executed. And the judge absolutely silenced her and said, you can be held in contempt of court. I can fine you and I can even put you in jail. I mean, this is the survivor of the crime whose dad was killed. I mean, she's like the closest person to this crime that there is, right? And so what I realized that that's part of why there is one narrative around this, is when victims' family members go public and are vocal for the death penalty and they fit that narrative, they're given, you know, a microphone and all kinds of resources. When the victim's family believes in alternative forms of justice than the death penalty, they can actually be gagged. They can be given a literal or figurative kind of gag order and told not to speak out, or they could be in contempt of court. So that's stuff that, you know, you don't necessarily think about, but I kind of started seeing, you know, all of this and asking questions about, you know, the folks that participate in carrying out the executions, you know, so I'm sure we'll talk about some of that, but there's so many appendages that this thing has, right? And that's one of them, is that I know families who have gotten an execution for the person that committed the crime that killed one of their, you know, of killing one of their loved ones, and they can still be really held hostage to the anger and the hatred and resentment. And I know other folks like Suzanne that they've decided not to pursue the death penalty, and they've really found other ways of healing from that, you know. So I think it is important that, you know, if we really believe that the death penalty is the only form of justice, then we're failing over 99% of murder victims' families, because in almost all cases, they don't get the death penalty. And we can talk about, you know, why that is, but I just don't think that the answer to a world with so much death is more death, right? I think that we can do better than the death penalty. And that doesn't mean that we're, you know, turning a blind eye to evil or to violence in our world.
Wow. Yeah. The, so my question for you is, you know, in this day and age, everything seems to be about like identity politics. And with, you know, you got conservatives, you got liberals, Democrats, Republicans. And it's like, if you are a, you know, prototypical conservative / Republican, you're supposed to believe all these different things. Like, you know, I'm pro 2A, you know, I'm for the death penalty, I'm pro-life, so on and so forth. Just kind of list all of them down, you know. And in your book, you made a quote that said the Bible Belt has become the death belt. You know, the Bible Belt traditionally is sort of associated with, you know, conservatives and what have you. So I'd be curious if you can kind of explain a little bit more about that quote and what do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, what's interesting on the death penalty is that there is a real nonpartisan effort to rethink it. I mean, criminal justice reform, the death penalty, there's some states where conservatives are leading the way to alternatives to the death penalty. In fact, there's an organization, national organization called Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, right? So, because part of this, as you look at it, is that when you look at the real data, I mean, a lot of folks haven't thought a whole lot about it, but once you start to look at it, you see, wow, it costs more to carry out executions than life in prison. You know, when you look at the data, you see, like, this is not a deterrent of crime. I mean, police chiefs all over the country, it doesn't even make their top 10 list of things that actually are effective in deterring crime. And often, because when you're killing somebody, you're not really thinking about the consequences, right? And so there's all of these different things that you, and so you sort of come back and you go, okay, then how do we still have the death penalty? And what haunted me is that the answer to that is the Bible, and Christians have been the moral backbone and the theological foundation for defending the death penalty. And as a Christian that grew up in the Bible Belt, this is why that messed with me, is over 80% of the executions in our country happen in the Bible Belt. The Bible Belt is the death belt.
It's amazing.
Where Christians are most concentrated is where we've held on to the death penalty. And that really begins to mess with me because of some of these fundamental, like, I mean, for starters, we're worshiping a savior who was a victim of state execution, you know, like, so there's all these, you know, layers that I began to look at that through. But, you know, I thought, man, that it must really break Jesus's heart that the death penalty has survived in America, not in spite of Christians, but because of us. And when it comes to this idea of being pro-life, incidentally, this is one of the places that I really abhor the partisanship, because there's not a party that has a really consistent ethic of life. But when I call myself pro-life, I used to just think about abortion. But now I think about that kind of pro-life ethic being from womb to tomb, right? From the not just pro-birth, not just anti-abortion, but I want to be a champion of life. If I believe every person is created in the image of God, and I still care about abortion, but I also care about the death penalty and gun violence and the movement for Black lives and racial justice, you know, welcoming immigrants. There's so many issues of life that really weren't on my radar when I talked about what it meant to be pro-life. So I want a more robust, you know, bigger ethic of life, not a smaller one. And that's part of where my opposition to the death penalty comes. The last thing I'll say about this is that it's so important that there's the faith element, but there's also a race element to this, right? And it's not just the Bible Belt, but it's also the states that held on to slavery the longest, that are the same states that have held on to the death penalty. So I'm sure we'll want to dig a little bit more into that. But it's impossible to talk about the death penalty divorced from our history of racism and slavery. And so in the middle of this, you know, era, you know, I hope it's more than an era, but this time of racial reckoning in our country, certainly one thing that's surfacing is the death penalty and that kind of legacy, an evolution of lynching to executions, because where lynchings were happening 100 years ago is also where executions are happening today.
Well, you know, on that same vein, dealing with race and kind of the disproportionate application of the death penalty to people of color, you know, I'm thinking back again. So like the interview we had with Karina Lane was focused more on the law, the constitutionality, so on and so forth. And she mentioned, you know, how disproportionate, you know, Blacks in particular, you know, are affected by it, you know, and she made a comment about, you know, you talk about Black Lives Matter, and she's like, there's no other topic where Black Lives Matter more than when you talk about the death penalty. And I asked her to talk about George Stinney, the 14-year-old that was executed, you know, and I was really surprised by her response. It wasn't, you know, yeah, this was just a one-off scenario. I mean, she basically said, you know, like that, unfortunately, there's so many other cases that are similar to George Stinney's, you know, maybe not necessarily with the age, but the circumstances surrounding it. And I know that you dedicated a section in your book to talk about the death penalty race and the history of lynching in America. So I'd love to kind of get your take, you know, on you know, race in America, as it applies to the death penalty. And then maybe we can actually even expand that out even further and talk about, you know, do we see the same disproportion, application of the death penalty in other places of the world?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned George Stinney and, you know, this 14-year-old who was killed by electric chair, by an all-white jury, convicted in just a matter of hours, right? I think he was given ice cream before they killed him. Like, he was a kid, and he was only accused of this crime, and it was a horrific crime of two white girls who were killed, I believe, was the victims of this crime, and yet there was no evidence for him, and so he ends up going to this, I don't even want to call it a trial, right? He's really convicted and sentenced to die. And he's so little that the story goes that he couldn't even get to the position where the electric chair would kill him. And so he had to sit on his Bible. I mean, all of that kind of encapsulates so much of what's wrong with the death penalty, right? And this is just over 70 years ago. And so just recently, a judge posthumously exonerated him, right? But yeah, I mean, you can't bring someone back from the dead, right? So that's part of why I think as we look at this, this is about the 14-year-old George Stinney, but it's also about all of the other iterations of that we see, right? So here's what we know is that if you kind of rewind to the 1950s, as we were beginning to move from lynching to primarily like state executions, African Americans were like 10% of the overall population, but they were 75% of our executions. And there were crimes that were punishable by death for African Americans that were not even crimes for white folks. I mean, that's one of the things that's so important is that we've evolved in our sense of in the death penalty, right? You even think of the Salem witch trials, right? Where we had, yeah, like literally these were from the Old Testament. These were crimes like bestiality and sorcery, mm-hmm, and witchcraft that were capital crimes because it said so in the Bible, right? And yet you add the element of race to this and it becomes, it's even more sickening, right? That we were, so you kind of go forward to, you know, where we're at now is that African Americans are about 13% of the population, but they still make up almost half of death row, and over a third of our executions. So disproportionately people of color. So we kind of have this idea that we need the death penalty for the worst of the worst, right? And yet that's not the reality of what's happening. You know, we'd like to think that we are killing the worst of the worst, but we're really killing the poorest of the poor and disproportionately people of color. I mean, you think of Jeffrey Dahmer. He didn't get the death penalty, right? Charles Manson died of natural causes in prison. Harvard-educated Ted Kaczynski is still alive. You know, what ends up turning into an execution what determines that is not the atrocity of the crime, but it's often the resources of the defendant and arbitrary things, right? Like things I didn't necessarily think about till I really started studying it. But the race of the victim is a very clear determinant of who gets executed. When the victim is white, the death penalty is sought much more frequently than when the victim's a person of color. And in some states, it's almost unheard of to have the death penalty for a white person who killed a person of color, right? So all of that you see kind of like really, you know, you see it surface in the death penalty in ways that, you know, as my friend Brian Stevenson said, the criminal justice system, and death penalty in particular, is one of the least evolved social structures in society. It's been the least impacted by the civil rights movement and social change. So, yeah, I mean, we still, I'm going to keep letting you guys talk, but, but I mean, it is.
No, I mean, we're here to talk with you.
It's maddening as you look at this. I mean, we still have defendants, African-American defendants, who were referred to with the N-word during their trial by the judge, by the prosecutor, but get this, sometimes even by their own attorneys, right? And so, you know, you start to see this stuff and you see like cases like Dwayne Buck, to be very specific, in his case in Texas, when it came to sentencing, right? There's a separate court case for sentencing. And one of the things that Texas asks is if someone's going to be executed, we need to determine whether they are in imminent danger, future dangerousness. It's this bizarre idea that's been, you know, debunked in so many ways that you can't determine whether someone's going to be violent. But this is what happened. An expert witness presented evidence, so-called evidence, that black people are more likely to be violent than white people. And this actually was heard by the jury during the trial. And Dwayne Buck, despite like years and years and years on death row without a single write-up, and you can be written up for having too many postal stamps, or, you know, like you can be written up for all kinds of stuff, and yet never an incident. In fact, he was called by prison officials a light in the darkness, an exemplary model, and yet he's sentenced to death. And I wrote a piece about it, sentenced to death because he was black. And I don't think it's hyperbole to kind of name that. And, you know, that's just one example. But I think, you know, as you really look at this, there are people that are for the death penalty in principle, that are against it simply because they don't believe that we can do it fairly, right? Like, and that is one of the questions, you know, that you start to ask is, as Sister Helen Prejean, you know, she kind of reshapes the question and says, sometimes the question isn't, does someone deserve to die, but do we deserve to kill? Because we've shown over and over and over that our institutions and our own racial bias, our own, you know, all of that, raises some important questions. And again, for conservatives, you know, that have a suspicion of how effective our government can be, do we really trust them with the irreversible power of life and death?
And I think the point you make there is, to me, the most compelling, in the entire book. Was it's the practice of death penalty and the issues with it. So I would probably fall into that camp that you're describing, that in theory, it seems like there's some kind of retributive justice, which we may get to talk about later, that is kind of built into the moral fabric of the world in the way that God made it from my worldview. And yet the way in which it's been applied has been so unjust. And so imperfect, that it's almost like in theory, I can understand it. And in practice, it's more difficult to say that it's something that should be, you know, allowed. I mean, just even your examples of like, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer and like, you know, these guys have done these horrific things and not getting the death penalty, are just mind blowing when compared to some people that do get it. And one of the things that came out to me in your book as I was reading it, probably the most disturbing part, was when you're talking about the lynching epidemic in America, and that you had mentioned in your last comment that as lynchings, executions went up, lynchings went down. And so, but you talk about like people going and like eating like Sunday dinner or Sunday lunch or something like that and watching the local lynching. And you mentioned like, I never heard about it growing up. People didn't talk about it much. And I'll be honest with you. I felt the exact same way. I'd known it was a thing. Obviously I knew that it was something, but I had no idea the prominence. I had no idea the social acceptance. And almost like, I think there's a quote I looked up the book, Jesus and the Lynching Tree, that you had mentioned. And there's this quote about someone saying, it's like how amazing it is that this is passed out of the American conscience or American memory, something that was so horrific. And I would love for you to kind of talk about like the connection between lynching and the cross that you make. Like you literally call Jesus the first lynchee. So the connection between lynching and the cross, and then what that meant for even African Americans. And Will, I would love to get your perspective as an African American, how you viewed it. If you guys talked about it growing up, maybe after Shane is able to respond, or in any order. But I just that was so profound to me, that whole section.
Yeah. Well, Will, jump in anytime on this, man. But I mean, I've taken a lot of my, I've learned a lot from folks like James Cone, you know, and the cross and the lynching tree, and folks who expose this history of racial terror, right? Of what we have done as white folks to African Americans. I mean, if for folks that really want to do some more reading on this, James Cone's book's great, Across the Lynching Tree, but you can also check out the Equal Justice Initiative that now has one of the most thorough studies of lynchings in America. Over, I think it's over 3,000 now documented lynchings. And wow. they show you county by county where those happen. And almost no memorials are in place to remember this, right? And this is one of our, this is not separate from the death penalty, right? But as Brian Stevenson, the founder of EJI, Equal Justice Initiative, says, is that the modern day practice of the death penalty is the direct descendant of this, right? That we see an evolution from slavery to mass incarceration. And we also see an evolution from lynchings of African Americans to modern day executions. And I mean, but this insidious, deadly theology is there, right? Literally to this day, the KKK has an entire section of their website defending their theology as a Christian organization, right? And these are folks that were, racial terror is the right word for it, right? That were hanging up people. I mean, I don't even want to, it absolutely makes me sick as you read some of these stories of pregnant African-American women that the baby was cut out of them, of people taking pictures beside the bodies of folks hanging from trees, like taking pictures and selling them, having, you know, dinner, going in thousands to watch these, the spectacle of death, right? And then going to church on Sunday morning. So this is why I think that that theology is still embedded in much of especially white evangelicalism. So the historic Black church, some incredible women and men that can help us have better theology because they identify with the executed, not with the executioner, right? And I think that's one of the questions is like, what does it do to us that at the heart of our faith is this executed and risen Savior, this brown-skinned Palestinian Jewish baby that was born that is now, you know, convicted wrongfully, executed on the cross, and that's what we're remembering. So what does that do to us, right? And if we get it wrong, I think it can cause us to have a really violent theology. I have people that still tell me, how can God be against the death penalty when God used it to save the world? And I'm like, man, we got to dig into that. We got to dig into that, right? So that's why this is a theological issue, right? And so to understand, as James Cone says, that Jesus was lynched on a tree, that does something to us as we understand Jesus as joining the despised peoples of the world, right? And I think that my understanding of what happened on the cross, even though it's a mystery, is that Jesus absorbed all of the violence of the world and made a spectacle of it, as Colossians says. That's what Colossians says, right? That Jesus made a spectacle of it on the cross in order to subvert it with love and forgiveness and an empty tomb. And if we miss that, we can end up making a spectacle of death in a way that we continue to defend it and undermine the very thing that Jesus came to do, I believe, which was to teach us a way out of the patterns of violence, right? And so I believe that even when we come to our theology of atonement, why did Jesus die? There are some versions that almost have God pointing a gun at humanity because of our sin. And then God takes the gun off of us and points it to Jesus and kills his own son. And I think that's one version of how you can understand Jesus's death. And I would suggest not the best one. I think that there's much more going on there, that Jesus is subverting all of the systems of violence. And as Rene Girard and many other great thinkers have said, Jesus was the sacrifice to end all sacrifice, right? He was like water put on the electric chair to short circuit the whole system of death. So if we, you know, even for those that were tracking this substitutionary atonement, you end up looking at Jesus and you go, man, that was it. You know, like, it's over now. There's no need for more blood. Like, Jesus' blood saved us all. Like, that's my theology, you know. And so I think anytime we now call for death, we are actually undermining the redemptive work of Jesus on the cross, which we're getting into it now, y'all. We're getting into it, but
that's good.
That's good. Now, Shane, I'm curious though. Like, so, do you think that the reason people are for the death penalty is because they're removed from, you know, the trigger, so to speak? You know, like I've always had this idea that if we were to, if the presidents wanted to bomb any place, that they had to like kill one person in front of them, you know, but not like with a gun, like with their hands, you know, because like, I feel like death comes so easy and becomes so easy of an option for people because, you know, we're not the one that has to pull the trigger or do whatever. So like, do you think there's a connection there?
Oh, absolutely, Will. I think that's a really important point, is that we have many layers of insulation that end up sort of making us feel like we have a system that kills, but no one really wants to feel the burden of that, right? And I mean, you see that in Jesus's own execution, you know, as we, you know, come out of this time of Easter, you know, we're thinking about this and you think, you know, there's all of these layers of people passing Jesus on, you know, and you get, oh, somebody's going to get free. Do you want Jesus or Barabbas? You know, and nobody wants to own the death. You got the kind of religious folks that are complicit in all of it, colluding with the empire. The empire's killing him. You got folks that are, you know, washing their hands because they don't want the blood of Jesus on them. So, I mean, and Judas, you know, that betrays his own brother with a kiss. So there's all of these layers, right? Think about the death penalty, right? We've got attorneys, you know, who open the door to death. You've got a jury that can find someone guilty. You got a judge that can, you know, sentence the person to death, a governor that nods in approval, signs a death warrant. You got a clemency board that kind of backs the governor and says, yeah, this was the right thing to do. You got a warden that oversees the execution, but usually doesn't cover it, you know, carry it out. There's a whole death team that works. And sometimes they're hired outside the prison because prison guards don't want to kill people that they know, like folks that they may have seen change over 10, 15, 20 years, you know. And so all of this, you know, a physician that may insert the needle. And so all of this is a system, right? And we sanitize it now through lethal injection. We make it look like a medical procedure. And yet at the end of the day, what is on the death certificate of an executed person, the manner of death is homicide. We have just killed someone. And even though no one may want to own that.
Really? I didn't know that.
In the traditional firing squad executions, even to this day, there's a blank bullet that they call the bullet of conscience. So that someone can, you know, as a firing squad, multiple guns go off. You know, as you hear it, like there's two people pushing the switch. Because no, it's actually kind of like that. Like with the firing squad, they even redesigned the bullet because you could tell if you had the blank bullet. So they wanted it to kick like a real bullet so that like literally every person on the firing squad could walk away with a clear conscience going, maybe I didn't do it. Right. So there's something about this. And I learned this as I interviewed Ron McAndrew, who did oversee executions. And he said it haunted him. I mean, as I talked to him, I still get chill bumps. You know, he said the men that he killed visited him in his sleep. One of them was killed by electric chair and his head began to smoke. And Ron McAndrew was like, this is evil, man. I'm done with it. And he said, I wasn't done with the death penalty. I was done with the electric chair. So he actually trained people in how to do lethal injection. And then he said, I was still haunted.
Wow.
Because even though he's a like tough on crime guy, I mean, this dude's not a softie, you know, he's like, you do the crime, you should do the time. He said, the death penalty is something altogether different because there is no good way to kill someone. I'll never forget him saying, there's no good way to kill someone. It does something to us. So I think that's, you know, why it's so important that we rethink the death penalty. And most of the world has rethought the death penalty, right? When I was born, I think there were only like 16 countries that had abolished the death penalty. And now that number is over 100. You know, most of the world has abolished the death penalty. In fact, the U.S. really stands alone. I mean, we're one of the outliers. When it comes to countries that still execute people, there's only a handful of them that do it regularly. And those countries are China, the number one executioner in the world. Saudi Arabia is usually in the top three. You know, then you have like Iraq, Iran, Yemen that are, you know, executing countries. And the U.S. is in the top 10, often in the top five of the countries with the highest executions in the world. So that's not, you know, those countries are not known to be champions of human rights. And yet we critique them. We critique them on all kinds of things. And yet they look to us
right.
And still execute, you know, so many people. So I'm excited because I think this is all shifting and changing, which is why, you know, I want to be one of those voices that, as we look back a generation from now, I really do think that the next generation is going to look back on the death penalty similarly to how we look back at slavery. And we think, my gosh, how did we think that was okay? And how did we use the Bible to defend it? And so I think this is a time where we really need courage because it doesn't take a lot of courage to say slavery is wrong now, you know, like it took courage to say slavery was wrong when that was the status quo, when you went to jail for it, when it was very unpopular, you know, so to say such things. So yeah,
yes.
It's a time where we need that courage.
You know, I think that's one of the things you mentioned was this bad, violent theology, this deadly theology. And you make a case in your book that number one, you talk about the Bible being written by several murderers were part of people who were writers in the Bible, which is true. And the Bible attests to that. And you talk about the limits of like an eye for an eye. And you go through the Bible and even Romans 13. I just had some questions. I'm trying to think about the best way to ask it. Cause I don't want to try to get you to do it all in once because it's too much. But if we think about, so here it is. When you think about like Romans 13, which you kind of go through and you basically say an eye for an eye is basically life preserving in some sense, like compared to the culture surrounding Israel. And for those who want to see this argument, Shane, you know, he lays it out in his book, Executing Grace. And both Will and I really, really enjoy the book and recommend it highly for you guys to pick that up. And in any of his works, he has a couple others that he said have come out and are coming out. When you look at Romans 13, which you talk about that big one, right, where it says that basically the government has the right to the sword. One thing that you say there is that Paul is essentially advocating a form of revolutionary subordination. And what I'm trying to help me understand and help our audience understand, what are you talking about when you say revolutionary subordination? And why is that important for understanding like our theology? Because as you listed those countries, all of them except for China are religious, deeply religious, right? And monotheistic. You know, I know America isn't monotheistic in terms of like a state religion or something, but deeply religious countries, except for China, at least in the government. So what is it when you're talking about this, like this combination of like, I guess my observation is that religion and this support of death penalty seem to be going together in these monotheistic religions. And a lot of it has to do with some of these arguments from the Bible, especially in the Bible Belt. What is it about this New Testament argument from Paul that you think we need to understand and that you want people to understand, and specifically about revolutionary subordination?
Absolutely, bro. It's a great, thing to explore briefly here. But I want to suggest one thing to start with is I think how we understand and interpret scripture is a really important question. That's a little bit more than we can get into. But what I would say that is that, that Jesus should be the lens through which we're interpreting scripture and through which we're understanding the world, you know, how to live in the world. And what often happens is we interpret Jesus in light of the Old Testament or in light of something Paul said, rather than interpret Paul and the Old Testament in light of Jesus, right? So, I mean, for instance, the Old Testament does have this idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Jesus himself even says, right? You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Moses told you this, but I tell you this. And this is what one of the things that we'll get to the Romans thing, but I think that one of the things that became important to me is not just to write off scripture, like the Old Testament has no relevance for today or something. Interestingly enough, one of the first big controversies in the early church was called Marcionism. And it was this idea that Jesus is better than the Old Testament God, you know, that God got born again or went through anger management, you know, and now we have Jesus. And that was deemed a heresy, right? But like what I see is, as I look closer at this, is that the eye for an eye was this ancient idea, a framework for justice, right? That allowed for reciprocal harm. That you could do as much harm as was done to you. It would balance the scales, right? So it was this idea that literally, if someone poked your eye out, you could take their eye out. But what we've come to interpret it as kind of a license for revenge, and it was exactly the opposite. It was a limitation, right? It was to stop the spiral of violence. So if someone broke your arm, you could break their arm. But you couldn't, you know, break both of their arms and burn down their mother's house, right? So anyway, it was, you know, it was to kind of limit that. And so, you know, even now, when we think of that, we would probably think, you know, we can do better than mirroring the evil, right? Like, you know, Will, if you poke my eye out, like, I don't think any of us are really going to think that's the best justice we can do is to gouge your eye out, right? Like, we don't rape people that rape, but we do like try to kill people that kill. And that's where Jesus comes and I think shines, because he's not negating that, but as he himself says, he's the fulfillment of that, right? So limiting violence was a good place to start. And now Jesus saying, I tell you this, don't even return the harm, right? You may have a legal right, but that doesn't mean it's morally right. It doesn't mean it's the best that we can do, right? So Jesus kind of shows us this way of transcending evil without mirroring that evil. Now, I think that, you know, as we look at, you know, even as you look at the Old Testament law, there were like 30 death-worthy crimes, right? So it wasn't just like capital murder. It was working on the Sabbath, you know, like disobeying your parents. I mean, there are all kinds of things that were, you know, death-worthy crimes. So I don't think that there are many people that are going to try to argue, like, we want to bring the whole death penalty back. But we do go to places like Romans, and you go, well, you know, God gave the state the power to kill. In fact, one of the critiques I would have, as many affirmations as I would have of Martin Luther and the Reformation, one of the critiques I would have is he's often been called the celebrity endorsement of the death penalty, because he said not only is the executioner the hand of the state, but the executioner is the hand of God, right? Because God has given the state this authority.
Wow.
Now, what I want to suggest is that the state is not infallible, and that actually the church is God's primary instrument for bringing the kingdom of God in the world, right? And that there are times where there is a collision between our fidelity to Jesus and the states that we live under, you know? So when I read Romans where it says that we're to submit ourselves to the authorities, I don't believe that that means that we're just to blindly obey them, or that we are to, give a blank check to government to do whatever it does because it's God's hand. And there are people that have done that. I mean, there are people that have done that in our country. Robert Jeffers, you know, First Baptist in Texas, like they've said that this gives Donald Trump or whoever's president, like just this, you know, authority to do whatever they want. But, you know, you start to think outside the U.S., you think, what does this mean? I've been to Iraq, you know, multiple times. And you go, what does this mean as an Iraqi Christian? Right? That like, did God put Saddam Hussein in power? You know? So I think there's holes in that theology that I began to unpack to say, like, you know, I don't think that even when that, you know, the Israelites demanded a king, God said, you don't need a king. I'm your king. They demand a king. God gives them a king and tells them all the things that a king's going to do. You make you slaves, make you fight the king's war. He's going to take all your stuff in taxes. And that's exactly what the kings have done. Right. And so when I think of the early church, they had this powerful way of reconciling this that I think, you know, revolutionary subordination. I think it was John Howard Yoder that first used that I came across it, is this idea that we are to be revolutionary even as we respect the authorities. So, for instance, there are two ways to respect the authorities. And one of them is by obeying the good laws. And the other one is by openly suffering the consequences of disobeying the bad laws. So I've gone to jail for civil disobedience, for nonviolently, prayerfully trying to stand against unjust laws. One of those, I believe, is executing people, right?
Wow.
So I'm willing to kneel down in front of the machinery of death to say, please don't do this, you know? And I'm willing to go to jail for that because it's that kind of civil disobedience that I think is the revolutionary subordination, right? So you think of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, you think of the Underground Railroad and Dr. King, you know, and the fight against apartheid. I mean, all over the world, there have been movements of revolutionary subordination that have exposed the injustices, right? By disobeying the bad laws and by standing in the way of injustice.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, the irony is the same Paul that wrote that we're to respect the authorities ended up going to jail for, and one of the things he's accused does is subverting the authority, right? And then he goes on to write Ephesians where he says, we wrestle against the authorities of this world. He uses the same word he used in Romans. So there is this powerful thing at work there that we need to name. Now, what I think happens with Romans 13 is that many people say that authority that's God-given extends to the death penalty or nuclear weapons or war. And I think every Christian committed to life should be standing against state killing in every form. Mm. And this is where the early church was so powerful in their witness, is that they spoke against killing. And they were champions of life. And the early Christians, there's a great book Ron Sider wrote called The Early Church on Killing. And it has sections on abortion. It has sections on the death penalty, sections on militarism and war. It even has sections on the gladiatorial games, because the early Christians saw that as one kind of manifestation of our fetish with violence in our society, right?
Right. So,
now, but the last thing I'll say is Cyprian sums it up really well. He was an early Christian bishop, right? And he said, when an individual kills another individual, we call it evil. But why do we sanctify it when the state does it in mass?
Mm.
So, you know, when an individual kills another person, we call it evil. But when the state does it, we somehow baptize it, right? And we sanctify it. And Cyprian and really the early Christians unilaterally across the board, they say, no, killing is wrong. No matter whether it's done by a criminal or by a governor or a president, like it is still killing.
Wow.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty heavy, and I wanted to end hopefully on a lighter note. So I wanted so I'll do it by talking about Dylann Roof. So six years ago, Dylan Roof, you know, he walked into the Emmanuel African and Methodist Episcopal Church in South Carolina. He opened fire. He murdered 9 people. You know, he's a self-avowed like white supremacist. And he was sentenced to the death penalty. And the reason I wanted to bring it up kind of as we close is because one unique thing happened to the folks that were victimized during that event that I think really kind of ties in well with your book Executing Grace. I'm showing it to the camera for those that are listening to this. I'm showing the book. it's a great book. It's weird. Like, side note, it's a double entendre, right? So like executing as far as like killing, or executing as far as like doing or exercising grace. So I thought it was pretty clever.
That's good.
When the perpetrators for that particular hate crime got a chance to go to the bond hearing, the judge invited them to make a statement so that way they can you know come face to face with the person that perpetrated this really heinous crime. One by one, the people stood in front, faced Dylan Roof, and mentioned and told him that they forgave him. They like executed grace in a way that I think we don't see very often. You know, they weren't with, you know, pitchforks and torches. They came one after the other saying, "I forgive you." You know, like, you took something from me, but I forgive you. And I'm curious what you can recommend to our listeners, our viewers. You know, how do we get to that expert level of grace? Like, what's the key? What's the, you know, what's the trick? What's the decoder ring that we need to use?
Wow. Well, one of the places I would start with, at least from my own perspective and my own experience, is that some things we only can have with the help of the Spirit of the Living God, right? And so I think the power to forgive that Jesus displays on the cross, right? Even as people are killing him, he's saying, "Father, forgive them, that for they don't know what they're doing." I find that, you know, I'm not saying Christians are the only people that can forgive or show mercy, but I do think that, at least for me, part of what I have encountered from the courageous folks at Emmanuel AME is that faith, right? I mean, they were worshiping Jesus when he did this. They invited him in to their prayer meeting to be with them, right? And one of those people that has become a dear, dear friend and hero of mine is Reverend Sharon Risher. Her mother was killed in that shooting. Her 2 cousins were killed in that shooting. Her childhood friend was killed in that shooting. And when she talks about forgiveness, it is not this shallow, "Well, you just forgive and forget." You know, in fact, it's just the opposite. She says, you forgive and you remember, because the scars are still there. And forgiveness is something we do with the help of the living God, you know. And she says, like, when I look at Dylan Roof, I don't see a man that needs the electric chair. I see a man that needs Jesus. And that's what fueled them, right? Is this belief that even someone with a heart as hardened and as racist as Dylan Roof can be made new by the grace of God, right? And that doesn't mean that the scars aren't there, the pain isn't there. And this is also why I'm not a single issue person, right? Part of how I've gotten to know Sharon Risher is that we've talked about the death penalty, but we've also talked about gun violence. And access to guns. And so I think these issues of life are all interrelated. And what we need to be having a conversation about is, what does it really mean to have that kind of consistent ethic of life, right? And the last thing I'll close this with, y'all, on that hopeful image, is that one of the things Reverend Sharon and I have been doing is we've been taking weapons and and transforming them in the spirit of Mike and Isaiah that talk about beating guns in the, they talk about beating swords into plowshares, right? But we've been taking guns, and for folks watching, this is a shovel that we've made out of the barrel of a gun.
And, oh, awesome.
You know, one of my most poignant memories is Reverend Sharon, as she took the hammer, she's beating on the barrel of a gun. And she named all nine of the Emmanuel Nine, right? Her family members, her loved wow. ones, as she's beating on that gun. And then she's in tears, right? And I'm like, I'm a mess, you know? So we're talking after, and she whispers, she says, "Everything I've deep down maybe wanted to do to Dylan Roof, I just took out on the barrel of that gun."
Wow. You know?
So that kind of power, though, right? That we need to channel. We've got to channel that pain into something that is redemptive, right? And that's what restorative justice is about, right? The best translation for the biblical notion of justice, it's often coupled with righteousness, right? The best translation that we have for the biblical idea of justice is restorative justice. It's not just trying to punish someone for what they did wrong. It's actually trying to heal the wounds. And it leaves room for the healing of the victims and the healing of the victimizers, right? That God's grace is that big. And that's what I would invite us to think about as we leave, is a better version of justice that can actually leave room for the oppressed and the oppressors, and heal the wounds of violence, not just create more wounds, which is exactly what the death penalty does.
Wow. Thank you so much, Shane. That this has been an awesome discussion, and I am humbled and so thankful. How can people get a hold of you or reach out to you if they want to learn more about who Shane Claiborne is?
Yeah, well, absolutely. First of all, I want to thank everybody that's listening, especially people that might be still leaning in, that these are new ideas. You know, this is challenging some of the things that we've, you know, the truths that we've held dear. And I think that it takes a lot of humility. And I'm saying this from my own experience, you know, to listen to people's pain, to listen to what Jesus might say to us, and, you know, have our hearts changed. So thanks for listening, first of all. And if people want to find out more information specifically on the death penalty, you can go to our website, deathpenaltyaction.org. I also have a website around executing grace with some sample readings that people want to kind of dip their feet in, which is just executinggrace.com. And folks can find out my schedule, things I'm up to on my website, shaneclaiborne.com. I'm on all the social media, you know, I'm on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook. But more than anything, I think we need conversations like this, right? Where we not only talk about grace, but we try to model it with each other, even as we're stretching each other's hearts and minds. So thanks for inviting me to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Shane. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And thank you to our listeners, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.